Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, where we discuss everything in the Hooniverse. Join us each week as we bring you news, rumor, and recap.
Spoilers.
We'll be discussing episodes that have already aired, as well as news that's already public knowledge. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again. And now your hosts, Jay Witten.
All right, fine. Put logic into my stuff. See how it is.
Melissa Mazza.
Drink every time you blink.
And special guest, Keir Hansen.
I gotta go.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio. This week we are here with Melissa and Jay and Keir Hansen tonight. So welcome, guys. How are you guys doing? What's up?
Very good, actually.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, no, my pleasure, as always.
All right, so tonight we're going to be doing the commentary for Dinosaurs on the Spaceship, one of the most divisive episodes of the series. This is kind of like the sushi of Series 7. It's like you either love it or you hate it. There doesn't seem
to be. I hated it. I think maybe I'll love it after we watch it this time.
We'll see.
I'm not going to help you on that cause, Melissa. I'm not going to be able to sway you.
Are you a fan of the episode?
No, actually, you know what? I just recently rewatched this and realized that it was just one of those ones. Well, we'll get into this, but I'm not going to start tearing it apart before we get a chance to watch it. I'll save my knife set.
This episode was just, it was very much, you know, it was fun, but that was about it. And I mean, this is kind of what we talked about when it first aired. It's a good like popcorn Saturday afternoon movie kind of thing. It's, you know, you're not going to get anything out of it, but you're going to have fun on the way.
Yeah, I mean, in theory, I have no problem with that. It's just the episode itself.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm going into it reminding myself that that's all it was, and hopefully we can, hopefully I can at least get that much out of it again. Well, so there were a couple things going on this week. Obviously, yesterday being Karen Gillan's birthday.
Yep.
Yeah, she turned 25. Made me feel old because I am now officially older than Karen Gillan. yeah, I'm 27 and she's 25. But yes, happy birthday to her. I also had some news. I was saying before. Oh my God, I saw this headline that says, Jenna Louise Coleman says, I wasn't meant to play Oswin. So I'm like, what can this mean? Does this mean that I don't know. And it's just, there's an article that I found on digitalspy.com, which always has Doctor Who news, in which she said that it's interesting actually that it was never the initial plan either to have me as Oswin. That was part of a genius plan that Stephen came up with halfway through the audition process. And she told this to Entertainment Weekly. And I know, I think this is the Entertainment Weekly article actually probably that you just sent me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, basically, yeah, so I thought that this was going to be something about Oswin, but it's interesting, though, that Stephen Moffat came up with that, and I haven't had a chance to read the whole article.
I've scanned it over a few times. It's got some interesting little bits of background. It's not going to be any sort of an eye-opening experience to go through, but it does give it a little bit of an interesting insight as to her auditioning process, her opportunity to be able to riff a little bit with Matt Smith in the secondary round of auditions, where they essentially just left him in a room together to work out a scene in the way that they wanted to convey it, and then the producers came back in and let them just sort of run with it unedited, and allowed her to be able to establish a kind of a riff with Matt in that regard. She also, she does mention about the idea of having the news dropped about Oswin essentially completely unprepared. And then she had to sit on that news and keep it from everyone, including her family, for some time, knowing that she was going to be brought back for the Christmas episode. It does have some interesting little bits of info about, does the Christmas episode and the introduction of the Clara character actually have any carryover? She does go so far as saying, as with all the Christmas episodes, they are encapsulated. So don't expect to see any of the threads getting stitched together that are going to explain where it goes from here. It's meant to be kind of enjoyed on its own. So
do you know what that makes me think? What if Clara is the one-off character and she's going to actually play Oswin the rest of the season?
No, because we have seen the picture of the Neil Gaiman.
Oh, right,
script.
The script. Yeah,
she's labeled as Clara, and that's been brought up before. So I think the character of Clara is going to be the thing that carries over. You know, I mentioned last week. I don't think that they're going to answer the question of the connection between her and Oswin in the Christmas special. Which I mean, that's of course they're not going to do that.
I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah, I mean, this Christmas special is different in the fact that it's usually the Christmas special is always a separate thing from the rest of the series. It's never been done in the middle of the season before. So they have a little bit of room to play with, but I don't think that, I mean, they're already changing the format. I don't think that they're going to go so far as to change the way that the Christmas special is done as well.
Right. There's actually a line of the Q&A from this article that directly addresses that, where it basically goes on and says, you know, is the whole idea of, you know, you played a Dalek on that episode, you're about to appear as the Doctor's assistant on the special for the Christmas episode, so it raises a bunch of questions as to whether or not this is going to be a subject, you know, the stitching of the two, or the three, really, because the carryover into the remainder of the season, mm-hmm. is this all going to be addressed in the Christmas episode? And she was able to at least say no, you know, we're keeping this, she refers to it as a quote-unquote soft mystery.
Mm-hmm.
So it is its own episode, and then the interviewer goes back and says, okay, Oswin, can you tell us whether, you know, knowing what we know about Oswin and what she proved to be, is your companion human? And which is a great pointed question.
Yeah.
And she dodges it pretty deftly. She says, well, it's difficult to say, it's difficult to talk about, but because of the way that things started off introducing Oswin first, it's difficult to really say much definitively where she's from, what period she's from, what planet she's from. And she just kind of leaves it very open-ended. So she's taking good lessons from Steemo.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, we've only got a couple more weeks until a lot of those questions hopefully will get answered. But
sure. And we are now officially within the 52-week window for the 50th anniversary.
Yes, yeah, that's the other big news. This past weekend, was it, I believe Saturday, was the 49th anniversary of An Unearthly Child.
Yeah.
So we now have 49 years of Doctor Who under our belt, and I know a lot of people have been doing retrospectives and looking back at things and the entire trip and what it's become now. And you know, if you look back at the Baker era or the McCoy era and see how things were going down, I mean, this is getting Serenity made after Firefly was canceled kind of miracle that we actually have this show now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Related to that, though, we have this little piece of a press junket that was released with our good friend, the Ninth Doctor, where he was being interviewed outside. I don't even remember what the context was of the point of the interview. It was something he was working on a project with Hugh Laurie at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And interviewer, you know, asking the usual things about what are you working on at the moment? So, you know, how's it feel to work with Hugh Laurie? Have you been a fan of his work and things? And then they threw in the question. So, 50th anniversary coming up next year. How do you feel about that? You know, what are you hoping to see come out of it? And he very quickly sort of batted the whole thing to the floor.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And said he didn't really have time to think about it. You know, he wishes it the best, but hasn't really given it much thought.
It's very much how he usually responds anytime someone brings up Doctor Who. He doesn't like to talk about it. You can tell he almost gets upset anytime someone brings it up. Unless that is the entire point of the interview that he's agreed to, he typically does start to get very irritated when somebody brings it up. And, you know, I thought it was kind of interesting in this that, you know, they ask him about Matt Smith. They're like, you know, have you seen him? What do you think of him? And Eccleston was like, yeah, no, I saw him on stage years ago. I haven't seen anything since then. I'm like, so you haven't even, wow, that's just harsh.
Yeah, don't know how truthful that response is. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an unavoidable thing in the UK to really, to not see it. But it's something, it's his way of handling it diplomatically. The fact that when they were asking him about his experiences with it and whether he'd want to return to it, and the fact that he said, well, it's been so long.
Yeah. It's like, no.
Really? Years. Yeah. Major point in your career. I'd cast a mind back every once in a while, I think. But, it's unfortunate.
Well, yeah, with Eccleston, I tend not to. I'm not going to believe that he's not going to be a part unless he comes out and flat out says, they ask me, I'm not doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, because he's one of those guys, he tends to flip-flop sometimes. Like, he'll dodge a question just to avoid saying, yes, I am a part of it. So until he comes out and says, absolutely not, I'm not doing anything regardless of anything, until he can say that or says, confirms it, I'm going to wait and see.
Yeah.
He's waiting for that bank lorry to back up to his house, drop off the cash.
Yeah.
But, I don't think he's going to be a part of it. I'm calling it now.
But then there's a follow-up question to that, though, Melissa. Are they going to use the doppelganger? Will they have a representative of the Ninth Doctor?
Yeah, kind of like they did with Tom Baker, or actually with William Hartnell and the Five Doctors as well. Mm-hmm.
Really need to be a major. I mean, speaking of that Five Doctors episode, Tom Baker was only in it for about, a whopping 2.5 minutes. Because he was in the middle of a project at the time, so they just shot some quick footage and kind of worked him into it. Mm-hmm. But would they do the same thing with the Ninth? He was only in it for a season. So he really doesn't need to be in the 50th episode for more than, 45 seconds or so?
Yeah, about that, yeah.
They'll just get some grumpy guy in a leather trench coat.
And see, I'm still wondering if, if they're going to make it an episode or if it's just going to be a celebration of 50 years of Doctor Who and kind of throw all the actors in as like, a kind of roundtable discussion or something like that. Just, something like that to where it's not an episode. Yeah. Well,
I think if it's going to be an episode, it won't even be like a full length episode. It would be just like the way that the webisodes were done, like a mini story. Somehow featuring as many people as wanted to come back.
They should treat it like Time Crash. It'd be one of those things, just the overlapping TARDIS.
Yeah, exactly. That would be kind of interesting to see, all the Doctors kind of piled into to one TARDIS. That'd be an interesting dynamic. I'd pay to see that.
Absolutely. Especially because of the fact that, you look at Colin Baker right now, he's not exactly shaped the way he was before.
No, not really.
Yeah. Tom Baker looks remarkably different.
Yes, very much so. I don't know. Whatever they do, that it's going to be special. So I'm very interested to see what they do wind up coming up with. And regardless of whether it's, a fantastic episode or a clip show or just, hey, 50 years Doctor Who, woo, here's a new, brand new one. Yes. I'm going to sit down, I'm going to watch it, and I'm going to love the heck out of it.
Yeah.
So that is our news.
Yeah.
All right. So I downloaded this episode on iTunes and I have it all queued up to go. Are you guys ready to watch some stuff? And we're just going to kind of talk over it and discuss.
Yeah. I'm looking right at the Egypt 1334 BC opening second there. So.
All right, so we will go ahead and get going, and if you want to sync up with us, we will start it in 3, 2, 1, go. See, this part here, I always lose track of what it is he's saying.
What did he say? I heard sorry about the sex.
No, he said
sorry about the mess.
Oh.
Well, it could have been synonymous.
No, this, right here, where he's just kind of talking, trying to get out of it, but I never quite catch what he's saying there.
Yeah. Oh, when he's looking at the psychic paper for the message he received, or prior to that?
No, when she's got him pinned up against the TARDIS.
I think he's just babbling to get himself out of the situation. Yeah. Interesting call on the India Space Agency that they decide to make them the definitive interstellar force mm-hmm. defending Earth
yeah,
at this point.
Yeah, this is like 2357 or something. So for them to say this is the India Space Agency.
Yeah.
Nuffy.
I'm going to say this now because I know I'm going to repeat myself for the next roughly 44 minutes. I'm not really understanding the choice of Nefertiti and John Rydell.
Yeah, as their gang. God knows what reason he picks them up. He needs them for this case, and it never. Yeah,
it's it's simply to me. It just seems like, hey, these people wanted to guest star, so we're going to cram them in this episode that really has no plot to begin with. So
it's Lestrade.
Yeah,
exactly. I liked him so much better as Lestrade.
Yeah, I mean, he's a complete jackass in this one.
Mm-hmm. I just felt it was an unnecessary element to the episode to have this.
So was Nefertiti. They didn't need any of them, in my opinion.
Brian,
they need it.
This, if anything holds this episode together, it's Brian.
Yes, absolutely.
Out of everything, I've probably watched this episode maybe 3 or 4 times now, and it just seems that that's the only thing that I ever get out of it is, because the writing kind of doesn't exactly shine terribly brightly. The dialogue, the writing in terms of the structure of the plot and also the writing in terms of some of the dialogue and exchanges are they are what they are. But Brian is just, and just it's such a testament to the actor. He makes him so endearing.
Yeah. Really so humanizes it. Although, we've been watching these old episodes that are like movies where several episodes are strung together, and I think that this could actually compete with some of those.
Oh, in terms of cheese factor?
Yeah, I mean, no, just in terms of story. I mean, it will lose in terms of cheese factor, but it's up there. But, it's just a similar story. Like, they're trying to do like a movie a week in these episodes. Mm.
Yeah.
I think that this one could have been a fantastic serial in, like, I don't know. I think that this could have been a good Davison serial.
Mm-hmm.
But trying to fit it in with the current brand that we've got, it definitely seems a bit out of place at times.
Yeah. And this is not one of Matt Smith's better performances as the Doctor. Just in terms of what they've given him, he's very, very over the top goofy.
Yeah.
In this episode.
But then again, it's like, can you really play serious in an episode like this?
I mean, well,
it's dinosaurs on a spaceship.
But also, isn't he older in these episodes or something?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, we're now, the jumps that he's taking versus the pond time, if you want to call it that, are getting longer and longer. So he's jumping, 100, 200, 300 years for the 6 months that they've been apart in pond time. But I think what was really kind of bugging me with this episode in particular is he seems so unprepared, he's guessing his way through this. He has no idea what's going on, how to address it, how to handle any of the situations they're up against. It's completely by the seat of his pants. And it was really lacking, you mentioned him being older. There were moments in other Doctors, or even some other Smith episodes, where you see that tap into his centuries of knowledge.
Yeah.
He's been in these situations, he's dealt with these sorts of things before, and at this one, it's like, he just reacts. I'm not digging it.
Dinosaurs on a spaceship, drink.
Start drinking. You got this too. I'm telling you, this is a destructive episode for the drinking game.
Oh, very much so. I think that the only saving grace that this episode really has for me is the introduction of Brian. I mean, if Chris Chibnall got anything right, it was Brian.
Yeah.
Mm. And I mean, he carries Brian through.
Well, that's the thing, and it really hits its stride in Power 3.
Yeah, that's
which I think is a... Yeah, that's a far tighter episode. It's still a little goofy at times. Chibnall writes kind of goofy episodes, but when he gets to those endearing moments, that's his strength.
Yes, yeah.
He's not an action writer. He's just not.
which is why Power of Three was a better episode, because it was, you know, 75% sitting around staring at a box.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here it's, you know, you need something to carry this action, and he really can't do it.
Yeah.
There's such a difference in budget between this and the Power of Three. All these dinosaurs.
You just don't really need a budget in Power of Three, though.
Yeah, they're just sitting around looking at boxes.
Yeah.
We just need to make a couple thousand of these little black boxes. Get the prop department on the phone.
I don't know. I will say that watching this after seeing what was it, the Caves of Androzani so recently, I'm looking at these dinosaurs and thinking back to the magma monster, and it's just like, wow.
Just tell yourself, all relative for the time. All relative for the time.
Oh, I know, and I love the magma monster. It was just, it was such a Power Ranger villain that, you know.
No, I don't buy that all relevant for the time. I think if I had been sitting there in 1985 or whenever that was, I'd be like, man, that's a guy in a suit.
Pizza the Hut.
And now we go back to looking through the screen. It just irritates me so much. Like, you know, show me the characters or show me the computer screen. Don't try and give me both.
I don't mind this.
No, it doesn't bother me so much, but then I find myself really focusing on the graphics that they're looking at and wanting to figure out exactly what it is that they're reacting to.
That's what I'm saying. It's like you can't tell what's on the screen, and you really can't see the characters clearly either. So it's like, and here we are at Bad Wolf Bay.
Yeah, it really is the same set.
Well, one of the clearest open stretches without a parking lot in the distance.
Yeah.
Edit it out.
I really do love the moments between Rory and the Doctor.
They really are, yeah.
That just seemed very funny, the him sticking out his tongue. It was like, just reminded me so much of Tennant and how he had to like lick everything. It's like, apparently that's a Time Lord superpower right there.
And we have the trowel.
Did you just have that on you?
And I love how he's like not even, he's just flipping it up, flipping it up.
Very systematic digging, just fling sand in the air.
And we just saw the Christmas reference again.
Yeah. Hopefully this means everything's leading up to the Christmas episode and something crazy is going to happen in it.
No, not likely.
Yeah, they can't. They've got to keep it light.
It'll be light, but just mind-blowing. Hopefully.
It's medicinal. I mean, really, these two characters only serve to, you know, give Amy someone to talk to.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, because they, in a sense, they kind of get in the way of a lot of things. It's an unnecessary aspect, other than the fact that she needs to be off on her own with someone.
Yeah.
Amy tries to high-five her.
High-five.
I'm thinking, though, maybe the Doctor chose them because he thought they would be a good couple. And was basically like, these two people could survive one of my adventures. Why don't I have them come along?
Mm-hmm.
And here's the Tyrannosaurus.
Mm-hmm. Does that look like a raptor there?
No.
I will say they really did a good job with mixing the CGI and the physical props with the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really do feel like, I mean, there are times where you're like, yes, clearly that's CGI, but you really do feel like there are dinosaurs on the spaceship.
Yeah. There are times when you need the practicals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when the Triceratops gets it and that sort of thing, you know, the final moments with the doctor looking into his giant meatball eye.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And again with the screen.
Well, you're going to get a lot of that.
I know. That's just... It's a strange thing to pick up on when there's so many problems with this episode, but this is the thing that bothers me.
I just don't like when Amy knows how to do all this in the episode coming up.
Yeah, you just randomly push buttons. Nothing bad can ever happen then.
Or the fact that they pick up on the fact that you need to use the Star Trek method of addressing computer as computer.
Yeah. See, that I actually had to look and find out what the heck kestrels were.
I have no idea what a kestrel is.
It's a bird of prey in Europe, kind of like a hawk or a falcon, but...
Yep. All
right,
then.
It threw me off. I was like, what the heck is a kestrel? Because, you know, I heard thestral, and I'm thinking Harry Potter. I'm like, that looks nothing like a zombie horse. Yeah. Something bad was going to happen to Rory there when they got a hold of him.
You were hoping, weren't you?
I just wanted to see him die one last time before it was too late.
His dad defended him by bonking the thing in the beak with a trowel.
That's why it's important to carry a trowel. You never know when you're going to get accosted by dinosaurs. So I have to ask, Kier, what was your take on these guys?
I like the fact that they used Mitchell and Webb. I think that's a nice little tie-in. But the characters themselves, the dialogue is absolute garbage.
Yeah. I have to agree. And I think the fact that they put Mitchell and Webb in here, like, I love the two of them, and I think they're great, but I feel like they got wasted in these spots.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, make those two the two that the doctor picks up and throw Lestrade and Nefertiti in the robot suits.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, see, it's like she doesn't even make any mistakes. She just automatically knows, here, put this in here and push that button to... It's like taking someone from the 1920s and saying, here, operate the CD player. Okay, boom, done, you know?
Yeah, because this was technology that not even the doctor had seen before.
Mm-hmm.
A Silurian.
Kind of hoping they were going to use the Silurians a little more in this episode. They weren't all going to be killed off. I dig them. I think that's a great aspect of the show.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I love seeing Madame Vostra back for the Christmas special, but I'm like, I want more than that. I think that's such a great, you know, counterpoint to having human companions as the Silurians.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the interplay between them.
I don't know. It seems really, really forced.
Oh, a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
And here and again, comes.
This is again Brian saving the episode.
Yes. And the doctor goes racy. I love it. Rory covers his eyes like, oh god, I don't want to see this.
Best reaction ever.
Oh yeah. I love how the saliva is just like so sticky and gluey.
What's an herbivore? Very pasty.
That's another joke that I'm surprised they haven't used more often. Take us to your leader.
Another 45 seconds I could have gotten left on the editing room floor.
Yeah, but who needs plot when you can have flirting?
They're Amy's companions.
Yeah, and they really are. I mean, that's the only reason they put them in here.
Surprisingly good question.
Egyptian queen and big game hunter from the early 1900s just have absolutely no problem with the fact that there's life on other planets and things. And
I like that they, that's what I love about this show, like that no one ever is surprised, but like I like to think that that's how it would be.
Well, I mean, we get the impression that they've both had a little bit of history with Doctor at this point. Nefertiti now from whatever little escapade they just came out of.
Yeah.
And he's gone back to get Rydell.
Yeah.
It's amazing how many people the Doctor just exposes to, you know, the breadth of space and time. And they go about their normal lives from that point on. Oh, yeah.
Like you do.
Everyone but me, it seems.
I had first contact, but it's no big thing. Sorry.
I mean, that's one thing that they do address in Torchwood that I liked was, you know, dealing with life after you learn about this, where, you know, Doctor Who, it just kind of gets brushed over.
Mm-hmm. We haven't got time for reactions and responses.
No.
There's rubber monsters to fight.
I expected that to be carried through. I really did.
I love that. All the references in a couple of episodes to him being a classical musician in all these famous pieces.
Yeah, but it's just this episode in Asylum of the Daleks. They drop it after this.
I thought there was one more. No?
No.
I thought there was.
No, not that I can recall.
Yeah, me either right now.
And here we get the... Oh no, that's right. He doesn't reveal until later. He just scanned the Doctor.
This, you know, these are the moments when Chris Chibnall has the opportunity to really put some great material together. These exchanges where they start to dig into some of the deeper things. It's not about, you know, how do we escape the robots shooting lasers over our shoulders or run away from the pterodactyls and those things where his writing gets a little thin. These little moments are really I don't know. I think this is really what kind of holds his writing together.
Yeah, it's the dialogue and the character development and things like that that he is actually really good at.
Yeah. This scene, though, in particular, struck me as very, like, 80s. This would have been at home in Caves of Androzani.
How so?
It's just, like, the use of such broad villains, like, he doesn't, we get to know him a little bit, but he's not as nuanced as we've gotten to know from other Doctor Who episodes. I feel like that's a very, like, old kind of thing. And then just the set and the lights and the colors that they use, like, the palette is just very, I feel like they're purposely making this a throwback to some older episodes or just an older kind of aesthetic.
And that is one thing about Solomon that bothered me from the get-go, is he's very just one-dimensional. He's a one-note villain that just, you know, he doesn't really have any depth to him. He's just, you know, I'm evil because I'm greedy.
Well, I think that was a conscious decision, though. I think they really wanted to make him as perfectly self-serving as he could be. They didn't really have enough room to be able to develop him further, because you had the rest of the episode to plow through.
Well, can I just say, though, on a more cynical level, they couldn't have made him too relatable because of what the Doctor does to him later in the episode.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
I'll throw down the spoiler gauntlet and just start racing ahead of this. Anybody who's watching this thing for the first time, first of all, shame on you. Watching it for the first time with us babbling through it. So,
exactly.
But otherwise, since I'm just going to jump to the conclusion here, this was the first instance where we now start getting into the Doctor's killing spree. Or attempted killing spree, where, you know, I know how to get us out of this mess. Let's kill the antagonist. That's a way to go about it. But
That's true. Yeah. In a town called Mercy, he was ready to do it.
He was ready to go.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, this is the Doctor. He is far from innocent. You know, he has taken more lives than you can count.
Right.
And plenty of times done it himself instead of just letting it happen.
All the more reason not to trust him.
You start talking about, you had seen that there's a video out there, I'll find it for you if you haven't seen it, where one of the video bloggers had put together, discussing, I think it was right around the time that this episode aired, and there was a huge kerfuffle about the Doctor as a murderer, or as a vigilante sort of a thing, mm-hmm. and people getting all up in arms about it. And his standpoint was, folks, this is nothing new.
Yeah.
But this is the first time you've seen it from Smith.
Yeah.
Now,
and that's what it is.
Yeah, and even if you go back to and backtrack a little farther, if you just take it 9th and 10th, you see very little of this. You have to go back a ways to see, you know, the moments where the Doctor just left the villain to die or put him in a situation where you knew that there was no way out of it. And some of them were very cold-hearted or just very cut and dry.
Yeah.
But we were hoping, I was hoping, that he's evolving a bit in terms of his reactions to or how he handles these sorts of situations based on everything he's been exposed to. I understood a little bit that you would get it from Ninth Doctor if he ever made that kind of a turn, because he was bitter. He was so bitter.
Very much so.
And Tenth, because he spent all that time on his own post-companion and it really took its toll on him. I could have seen it then.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's got this lovey-dovey little family.
Well, and this could feed into the theory that, you know, that according to the Doctor's timeline, this comes after Angels Take Manhattan, when he's already lost Amy and Rory.
Mm.
So if he had just gone through that, then maybe that can start being his downfall. You know, so it's...
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily his downfall. Like,
or his darker turn, we'll say.
Yeah. But I think the whole point was that he's always kind of had a darker side, and it's, the Doctor, as I see him, is like a superhero, you know, and Superman always had his bad days where people died and stuff.
See, this right here kills me. Yeah, this guy is admitting to genocide, and not just like simple, I did it to save something, you know, the doctor style genocide, but we're talking like Holocaust style genocide, where he's like, no, I put them in there a dozen at a time, waiting for someone to say something, and they just, you know, shut them out the airlock. And, yeah. I mean, this is, you know, completely heartless.
Yeah. Well, the motivation behind it's not even genocide, because genocide is typically some sort of an ethnic cleansing or something that's done because you feel like you have a justification for your race, your creed, your history, what have you. This is strictly done because he wanted possession of what they had, means to an end, pure greed.
Yeah. And it's just the cold, heartless nature of the way that he killed him, and it just gets brushed under the rug like, yeah, I did it. And then we move on with the episode. It's like, you know, that carries a lot of weight, and they just didn't give it.
Well, that's the thing. If peace, he has the opportunity right there to really start to carry it. Yeah, there goes his face. He's all, hey, run off.
Yeah.
And then he doesn't turn dark again until we're reprogramming the missiles to go after the smaller ship.
Yeah.
Inconsistent.
Very.
Yeah, and this is where he turns overly goofy. He goes from so dark and, you know.
Yeah, like, I can understand him killing him at that moment when he admits to it, but no, now he jumps on the back of a Triceratops, goes for a little joyride, and then decides, okay, you know, now that I've had my fun and I'm in a good mood, now I'm ready to kill someone, you know.
Yeah. I'm trying to think how that could have been better handled. Maybe if he hadn't been actually privy to all of that backstory yet, you could still get through these sort of, you know, happy crappy action scenes where we're racing around, because he should be carrying a lot of that weight with him right now.
Yeah, because I mean, all right, not to hate on Matt Smith, but you know, imagine if Tennant had learned that, he would have gone deathly serious and been like, "There's no power in the verse that can save you now," you know. Yeah, whereas Matt Smith just, you know, brushes it off.
But maybe he's holding it for later, whereas I think Ten would have reacted right away.
Well, see, but again, I think you got to take, he's working with what he's given.
Mm-hmm.
That's the script he was handed. The script is laid out in that order. If you're supposed to have a moment, you know, a scene like that with that sort of exposition, and then have a chase sequence, and then come back to the final confrontation with your baddie, there's only so much you can do with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a fault of the script and not the actor or anything like that. It's just...
Yeah.
And here comes the most emotionally hurtful part of the episode.
Yeah.
You know, clearly this woman has not worked with the doctor very much. If the doctor says I'm going to take care of it, then, you know, it's going to be a last-second thing.
Well, she has to define the clock, then. In order for it to be a last-second thing, she has to start the clock.
Good point.
All right, fine. Put logic into my stuff. See how it is. Now, first off, how does he know how to work these guns? Second of all, how does he know that they're just tranquilizers?
He's a big game hunter on the African plains, as he introduces himself to people.
Who usually uses energy weapons and stuff.
You know.
Not just a bolt-action rifle.
Yeah. I love that part. Amy slipping and saying she's Rory's queen.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have the fish.
I love the way that Arthur Darvill plays that, just completely no-sells it. Aside from the look of disgust, he just completely no-sells it.
Is that his best?
I am going to miss Arthur Darvill.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Now, someone had pointed this out to me before, and it sticks through Series 5. I haven't had a chance to look through Series 6 yet, but you can always tell where they are in relation to the present by the color of the Doctor's bow tie. If they're in the future, he's wearing a red one. If they're in the past, he's wearing a blue one.
Okay.
Really? I don't know how long it carries over, but it works all the way through Series 5.
Interesting.
I can't even tell what color that is.
I know, it looks kind of purple.
Yeah.
It's the color cloth.
Yeah, we just completely talked through the part where they start building up the tension about the Doctor not existing anymore.
Which I thought would have been the more valuable trophy.
Yeah, something that just isn't supposed to exist. But Solomon is one of those guys that works clearly off of the price tag that a scanner tells him.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh. This part just kills me.
Does this remind you guys of the scene in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids? The aunt. This is what it always reminds me of.
Well, it does now. Thanks.
Oh, way to drag that up.
I gotta go.
I have to say I like the way that Nefertiti stands up now and says, no, this is my choice. You know, she doesn't just let the Doctor play it all out. She kind of takes control.
Yeah, you kind of see in this episode how anyone that he would choose to hang out with, the Doctor, like, you know, has balls, basically.
Well, we've already seen Brian's. Come on, you have no idea what a robot is. You can probably think you can take it. He's very adept with those crutches that he just had made for him.
Yes.
Good point.
It was a good thing I decided to put blades on the end of my polio crutches.
I don't know, he just seems odd without carrying a cat around.
Mm-hmm. I caught him lurking in the hallway.
Harry Potter reference for those of you that don't get it.
My God.
All of a sudden now, the computer talks.
Yeah.
Just noticing, by the way.
Yeah, that's true. That's the first time we've heard it.
And of course it has to do the repeat the phrase 5,000 times gag.
Well, of course. I mean, what else are computers on spaceships for?
I don't understand why the dinosaurs are suddenly a threat now.
because that's the way that Chibnall needed it to be.
Yeah, this whole episode, yeah.
Cue the raptor attack.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the doctor's working on something. There needs to be some sort of exterior tension. I kept waiting for him to turn to the side and say, "Clever girl."
Again, another instance where the doctor really doesn't have any ideas or how to follow things, and Brian saves the day.
Of course. Brian Bond.
He raises his hand. I love it. Not a pond. Of course you are.
I do have to admit I like that joke there.
How about the Silurian audience?
Yeah, about the two monkeys flying the ship, yeah. Clearly Brian is a very adept video gamer that he can just pick this up so quickly. I expect it from
you
Rory.
You take it for granted that Rory is, yeah.
Well, it's because he's Rory Pond. I mean, you know, what can't the guy do?
Keep control of his wife?
Yeah, well, that's a bit much.
And then comes the exchange that threw the audience for weeks.
Yeah. It bothers me hearing all the lead up to them leaving.
Mm. But she's absolutely right about the weaning us off of you thing. Mm. What if he, this is post-Pond, and he, like, the, and that's exactly what he's doing. Like, she's thinking it's like, you know, he's put a couple years between his visits, but like, it could also go backwards that he's put a long time between their visits.
Mm. I'm easily worth two men.
Lessons in gender politics.
It's been a while since Amy's had an action sequence.
True.
I'm starting to remember why. They just seem very staged.
Whatever. Shooting at dinosaurs is awesome. No matter how staged, I'd be like, yes, I'm doing that scene.
Interesting that we are now, you know, 300 years farther into the future and we have not developed a missile system that could be called off.
Oh. Yeah.
I still love that they sing
Better than
Daisy
golf.
Bell.
Oh no, I'm a second behind.
I love that the robots sing Daisy Bell when they get shut down.
This episode is crammed with references to things.
Yeah, very much so.
That's my takeaway.
And see, he seems so nonchalant about the fact that he's about to murder this guy.
Yep.
But as you've said before, Jay, like, he plays his cards close to his chest. Like, he's probably been thinking this whole time and, like, realizes that there's no possible scenario where Solomon lives and everything's all right. So he's fine with it by now.
Yeah. I guess maybe a little bit. It just, it seems strange that, you know, he doesn't care at all.
Well, I don't know. Well, because here's what happens. You've got, in this particular case, he's got, he gives his little death sentence conversation mm-hmm. with high eyebrows and a clear face. Mm-hmm. You go into a town called Mercy where he's about to throw him over the line for the, you know, for the
gunslinger.
Wanting to refer to him as the, mm-hmm. I keep wanting to refer to him as the RoboCop. But in that, it's a much more heated and violent outburst. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, based on the writer, based on the director of the episode, you pull something very different out of Smith in a very similar situation. So, again, this allowed me to, even though this is a very goofy Smith episode, I can't blame him too much for this one. I think it was really just a matter of him being treated with kid gloves from a writing and a directing standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, I really don't have anything against Smith in this episode, because it clearly was not his issue. I mean, we've seen Smith do some amazing acting, and he's just done a fantastic job as the Doctor.
Oh, and so, here is the scene that, for me personally, justified the entire episode.
Exactly.
Definitely shades here of Wilfred Mott.
Mm-hmm. I love that visual, though, of him just sitting there with his feet dangling.
I'm gonna miss the ponds. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, I got some high hopes for Clara. I got a feeling she's gonna bring some of that Donna Noble, take no truck kind of response that he needs to ground him.
Yeah, I'm gonna love Clara. I already know that. I've already made up my mind, but she's not gonna be Amy and Rory. Yeah. And that's it.
I didn't understand this. Siloria is not a real place. I'm like, what?
Well,
I don't know.
I always took it as the Doctor dropped the dinosaurs off on a planet and named it Siloria.
Named it Siloria, yeah.
In honor of the Silurians.
Gotcha. Okay, well, that was that episode.
Yeah.
What would you guys rate it out of 5 stars? What would you give it?
It's... because of the fact that I keep wanting to poke holes in it, I can't even give it a 3 and say, the episode was fine. Because I just had too many things that just kept pulling me out of it. So I'd have to say that's a 2.
I'd have to agree. I mean, it wasn't completely horrible. It's, you can have fun watching it, but it's by no means a 5-star performance or even a 3. Like you said, it's, I'd go 1.5 to 2 at best.
I'd give it a 1. I still have the feeling, like I did when I first watched it, that I'm missing something, that like if something just clicks, I'm gonna realize that this was an amazing episode and something, but it hasn't clicked yet. I give it a 1, I think.
I would keep it at a 2 personally, just because at least it does give us the introduction to Brian, who mm-hmm. becomes just such an endearing character.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you've watched through Brian's entire arc through the little special PS, it's you really do get a feel for the character, and he's honestly, I love him just as much as I do Amy and Rory now. Yeah, and with 2 episodes and a storyboard, that's saying something about the character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So next week we will be doing A Town Called Mercy. Looking forward to that one.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not going to say anything about the Mork from Ork ship or anything like that.
So. Oh, it definitely has its weak moments. I do give you that. But coming off of the episode that we just watched.
Oh, yeah.
I think they primed us to just love whatever comes like.
Anything. I don't care.
You know, the space western really isn't all that great. Let's put dinosaurs on a spaceship in front of it. That way nobody notices. All right. Well,
thanks so much for allowing me in on this, kids.
Thanks for joining us. It's a lot of fun doing these commentaries.
Yeah. So we'll get a proper drinking game going for the next time around.
Complicated.
One that isn't just a mention of two of the words from the title.
I think,
is it Town or Mercy?
All right. Well, you guys have anything else in closing?
No. Thank you again, guys.
Yeah, keep an eye on the news. More stuff will be coming out now because if they allow some of these initial interviews to start to come out, then it won't be long before Simo has some things to say. If we draw closer to the Christmas episode, news will happen.
It's coming up quick.
We're really close to the Christmas episode, so.
All right. Well, this has been episode 15 of Gallifrey Public Radio, and we'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week on iTunes or at gallifreypublicradio.podbean.com. Have something you want to say or just want to say hello? Send us an email at gallifreypublicradio@gmail.com or leave us a comment on iTunes. You can also find us at Twitter at Gallifrey Radio. We love getting feedback from listeners, so feel free to share your thoughts anytime. Music by Ronald Indio and Redcon Addict. Sorry, this is the first time I've had to do a conference call on Skype, and so.
Oh, I know what you were about to say.
Your first three-way.
Very good. You've come so far. I'm so proud of you.
I think a good drinking game for, Angels Take Manhattan is, drink anytime something happens that is in conflict with some of the previous rules that were established for Angels and.
Yeah,
no,
that's true.
I got it. You'll drink every time. Drink every time you blink. You will not drink all that much.